May it please the court, good morning. My name is Andrew Hare. I represent William Willett. I'm obviously going to address the core issue in this case, which was the trial courts. And before I begin, I suppose I will distinguish between the hearing court, it was Judge Taylor, and then Judge Kearns presided over the trial. So I may refer to it as the hearing court or Judge Taylor or Judge Kearns or the trial court, because there were two judges in this case, and the ruling at issue with respect to the choice of evils defense was ruled upon in an earlier hearing by Judge Kearns, and then, by Judge Taylor, and then Judge Kearns presided over the trial and made a reverse ruling on that.
Mr. Hare, I'd yes. like to ask you a question before you even get started on that. Is it relevant what Judge Taylor or the earlier court ruled? Isn't the test whether there was evidence presented at the trial that would justify giving a choice of evils defense?
Well, choice of evils, the affirmative defense of choice of evils presents kind of a unique procedure. And I think in the answer to your question, it's necessary to kind of get a landscape of what choice of evils requires. And that is what happened in this particular case. Mr. Willett raised the defense. The statute requires that he obtain a pre-trial, doesn't have to necessarily be pre-trial, but it does have to be before he can introduce evidence of the defense. As a condition of presenting his evidence, he must obtain, as a matter of law, a court ruling that says that he has, in fact, raised a scintilla of evidence to support the defense. So in this particular case, that's what Mr. Willett did. It was about 2 months before trial, and he did that. As he proceeded to trial, he presented all of the same evidence that he had presented at the hearing, keeping in mind that his lawyer had voir dired on this, examined jurors, opened on it, cross-examined on it, had his client testify as he had at the pretrial hearing, testified in support of it. The prosecution cross-examined Mr. Willett, brought out his earlier statement at the hearing. There were some vagaries with respect to the timing of the weapons at issue. This is an introduction of contraband case involving a wooden shank, if you will, and a sock with some locks in it.
Well, before I give it up, let me give this hypothetical to
sure.
you. Let's say that Judge Taylor or the earlier ruling should have been followed.
Correct.
But the testimony at the trial did not cover the same points. In other words, evidence was not adduced of that would justify or require giving a choice of evils defense instruction.
And defense counsel below, in responding to Judge Kearns's concerns about the differences or the timing issue, if you will, basically mentioned that we're talking about a matter of 2 days, between 2 days, 4 days, or 5 days, as to how long he may have had these weapons. Defense counsel's hypothetical, kind of consistent with what your question, Your Honor, was, look, if Mr. Willett had got up on the stand and said it was 30 days or it was 3 months that I had these in my possession, in my cell, that would have equivalently been an abandonment of the defense. And yes, I think hypothetically, a trial court would have discretion if, for example, defense counsel abandoned the defense, or, for example, if the defendant testified to something so extremely different than what he had earlier testified at the pretrial hearing, that a court would have discretion to step in and say, no, that's not sufficient, that's not a scintilla
of
evidence.
Okay, thank you. I've taken enough of your time.
No, that's fine.
But I want to clarify, it wasn't entirely clear from your brief. The evidence presented at trial by the defendant was the same, basically the same evidence presented at the pretrial hearing.
Correct.
It all came in again.
Everything that was before Judge Taylor came in and was before Judge Kearns.
Okay.
The difference was some vagaries, some different potential differences.
The amount of time that he possessed.
Correct.
Okay.
But that, whether the jury would rely upon his earlier assertion or whether it was 2 days or 4 days or 5 days, that's basically the weight of the evidence, a question of the weight.
Right.
The jury would get to decide whether to believe it was 2 days, 5 days, and whatever it was, the jury would get to decide whether or not the prosecution could disprove or not disprove beyond a reasonable doubt the choice of evils defense.
Secondly, when counsel for the defendant made remarks, and I think you said in voir dire or opening regarding the choice of evils, was there any objection by the prosecution at that point?
There was absolutely no objection before trial, during voir dire, during opening, during cross.
No objection to this evidence as it came in again?
No objection.
Didn't come up till the jury instruction conference?
Correct. That's absolutely correct. Mr. Willett had no notice that a court could reconsider. And I think as a matter of, really, it's arguable whether I've said that a court could have discretion, but in this particular case, certainly the court, since it would have discretion in some extreme circumstances, I would assert abused its discretion here, because its decision to reconsider was informed by two manifestly wrong areas of law. One is the court interpreted, as the state acknowledges in its answer brief, it interpreted the statute as having this kind of two-pronged test. One is that the statute actually doesn't require a court before trial ruling as a matter of law. Rather, it's just a question of admissibility, and that the question of law issue doesn't come up until after the evidence is in. There isn't a case that supports any of that. That's not what the court, you know, rendered as its two-pronged analysis. It's not supported by any case in Colorado. The second thing that misinformed its decision is it's kind of the prism or how the court is viewing this evidence, what's informing its decision as to whether to reconsider. Well, the court applied what is, and as I've asserted in my briefs, and I think I've made pretty clear, is an incorrect test. Under Brandyberry, the court had erroneously relied upon People v. Bennett. We all know Bennett to be the seminal case in Colorado about substantial and sufficient evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt to, you know, reasonable minds of jurors, every element of offense. It's the MJOA substantial and sufficient evidence test with regard to sufficiency as to whether or not offense has been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. It has nothing whatever to do with the question of whether or not a defendant has raised by scintilla of evidence or under the statute some credible evidence to support a defense.
Well, let me stop you. The state doesn't disagree with you on that point. I think they agree that the proper test is some competent evidence. They're saying, in effect, Judge Kearns applied to some competent evidence test. So let me ask you about that. Did he make a ruling? What was his ruling for keeping out, for not giving the jury instruction? Was it that there was an absence of sufficient evidence to prove the choice of evils defense? Is that how you understand it?
The test that he employed, he rejected that it was scintilla. And with regard to the some competent, it's arguable whether some competent is the equivalent of some credible or scintilla. Mm-hmm. But this court, because it had rejected that scintilla is not the test, would necessarily have not found that scintilla, which the Supreme Court has said is interchangeable with some credible evidence. The court's not finding this in its Judge Kern's view that some competent is equivalent to scintilla. So that's
so he applied point. A higher standard, you would say, higher
correct,
and incorrect standard.
Okay. Yes.
The state says the higher standard he applied doesn't matter because it also, I think, wasn't, or even the some competent wasn't satisfied.
Correct. The state's assertion is that no evidence was presented at all to support this. But the point here is that Mr. Willett, the way that the choice of evils defense operates is that Mr. Willett proceeded to a legitimate, valid court who listened to the evidence, the prosecution was there, it was litigated, and it found as a matter of law that he had presented sufficient evidence. Again, it kind of ties back into earlier comments about all the evidence that was presented at that hearing was presented at the trial. There were some nuances within the facts, but that's a question of weight, not whether or not the defense has been raised. The court basically under its erroneous view of what was necessary to support the defense then focused on only this new nuance with respect to whether it was 4 days or 5 days. Well, it's in the light most favorable to Mr. Willett, and as I said, it kind of gets repetitive a bit, but he'd already presented the same evidence that another court had said supported by a scintilla of evidence the assertion of this defense.
It's your position that the some competent evidence test or the scintilla evidence. I like some competent evidence better because I'm not sure what a scintilla is, frankly. It sounds like a freckle or something, I don't know. The some competent evidence test also requires the evidence to be viewed in a light most favorable to the defendant who's
correct.
Seeking an affirmative defense.
And not,
Did Judge Kearns also fail to apply that standard as well, do you believe?
Well, it's focusing only on the new, and by the way, the court was initially ignorant of what Judge Taylor had both considered and ruled. It became familiar because the transcripts were available. But it's focusing on, yes, there's this new evidence, new time frame. The window is broadened a bit. And so the court is hanging its hat on this new evidence, failing to, I think, grasp.
How did the new evidence come up? I don't understand. I'm sorry.
It was in cross-examination of Mr. Willett.
Okay. Yes. Okay, so pre-trial he said I had 3 days, and in trial he may have said, 6 or 7 days.
2 days, and then okay. It was maybe up to 4 to 5 days. Something.
And like that really relates to whether it was imminent, whether the threat
Correct.
Was imminent. Okay.
Correct.
Which does not seem doesn't seem to be defined in the anywhere in any case
it's
law.
It's not terribly clear on exactly what that means, but again, with respect to Mr. Willett, once the court has ruled in his favor and that now it's before the jury, he has relied and detrimentally relied. Which again, and I think this kind of moves into the question of mistrial, that even if, assuming arguendo, that somehow Mr. Willett erroneously relied upon or went to trial and raised the choice of evils defense, he did so in reliance upon a court order, him properly following the law, him not being able to know that, Mr. Merson, defense counsel, said, look, I could not have foreseen that another court would reconsider and then change its mind or have a difference of opinion with regard to Judge Taylor's ruling, and therefore this does warrant a mistrial. It's prejudicial. It can't be remedied by other means. I had other defenses available, but I chose to proceed in this fashion. Therefore, in interest of justice, a new trial should be granted.
Let me ask just one last question. I know you want to save some time. Did Judge Kearns rule specifically that the evidence did not satisfy the imminent test?
I believe so, based upon this new, based first on its application of an erroneous standard and this new testimony and cross-examination from Mr.
But he did
Willett.
Say that having heard this testimony, I now find that it wasn't imminent.
Correct.
So this goes back to Judge Sternberg's question. If the evidence at trial failed to show what was shown at pretrial, it isn't a question of reconsideration. It just failed to meet the standard. That seems to be what Judge Kearns was saying here, the way you describe it.
Well, Judge Kearns, but it gets back to whether the court is applying the correct standard.
Yeah,
I think there's a danger that the state is going to get another windfall here. That the state would ask the court to review what has happened at trial when, again, this kind of also feeds into the mistrial question, where he has relied upon an order that says that he does, in fact, have this defense available, not knowing that another court could now review and change its mind, and then on appeal have your honors review yet again and decide that, oh, by the way, you didn't. We in our mind, you haven't raised this particular defense. I would respectfully ask to reserve the remaining time.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel?
Hey, please the court. My name is Brock Swanson, attorney registration number 39116, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado in this matter. Choice of evils applies only to emergency measures taken to avoid an imminent injury that clearly outweighs the injury caused by the emergency measures. And it is not available if there's any reasonable legal alternative. Before admitting the evidence supporting the defense, the trial court has to first determine whether the claimed facts would, if established, and that's what the statute says, if established, support the defense. And the Colorado Supreme Court has construed this statute narrowly and recognized that the legislature has created a very narrow defense here. Here, the trial court permitted the defendant to present evidence regarding choice of evils, but ultimately concluded that he had not presented evidence supporting instructing on that defense. I think the important thing here is that this is not a case where the offer of the proof and the evidence in trial were identical. During the offer of proof, As has already been talked about, the defendant indicated that only 2 days
Offer of proof, you mean the pre-trial hearing?
That's right. That's right.
It was more than offer of proof.
It
was testimony by the defendant.
It was testimony by the defendant. It was how they chose to pursue this offer of proof. But I think only an offer of proof is what is required by the statute. It says...
Okay, I don't want to bog you down in that.
During that pretrial hearing, the defendant indicated that only 2 days had passed between the creation of the weapons and their discovery. But at trial, he testified that it had been 5 days and that the jail had been in lockdown for more than a day prior to the discovery of the weapons, and that he had forgotten that he even had one of the weapons. And so all of these additional facts that he admitted to and the change in his testimony in regards to the time, I think that under all those circumstances, his creation and continued possession of the weapons could not be considered an emergency measure or to be in response to an imminent threat. And so that change, which was specifically relied on by the trial court when it made the post-trial ruling rejecting the instruction, was that when I have a fuller testimony and with that change in the testimony, that I know I can conclude that this was not an emergency measure in response to an imminent threat.
What statute or case law differentiates 2 days and 5 days from satisfying the criteria of imminent?
There's no case that I'm aware of that's directly on point on like exactly that situation of 2 days.
Then why isn't that a jury? Why isn't that a jury question then, whether it was imminent or not?
The cases are very clear, and the statutory language is very clear that this has to be emergency measure, it has to be imminent, it has to be urgent, and one case that particularly looks at this and discusses these terms and how imminent and emergency they is People versus Brandyberry, which is one of the cases cited in my brief, and looks at this emergency in. The idea is that this is something that just comes up all of a sudden, and you have to make a response at that time.
And think about this inmate. What was he supposed to do? He's supposed to wait till these two guys are coming towards his cell, then run and go get a piece of metal, and then sharpen it while they're on their way. I mean, how? It seems impractical to make. It takes away the defense of choice of evils. If imminent means you can only do it 5 minutes before, or an hour before, or even a day before.
Well, I mean, if we just want to look at the facts of this case, one of the weapons he had was some locks and a sock. And he testified that he's allowed to have locks and a sock. And in his cell, all he had to do was put the locks into the sock, tie it into a knot, and he had a weapon. And that wouldn't take any time at all for him to prepare that. That's what he was going to do, and he thought that was his sufficient weapon for him.
But, excuse me, but isn't what you're arguing really a jury question? I mean, here, the judge took that question away from the jury.
I think there is, it requires some line drawing, but there obviously has to be a point where we can say this danger is no longer imminent and this is no longer an emergency measure. And I think that the court, the line that it drew in this case was a reasonable line to draw, that if you're keeping this, it's not only that it's 5 days, but you're keeping it for 5 days, you're not even remembering that you had these weapons anymore, that the urgency is no longer there.
Is it your position that the trial court said that? That he said because his testimony changed?
Yeah.
Pre-trial 2 days to trial 5 days, I find that this was not an imminent threat?
Yes.
Is that specific?
Yes. I can probably find this.
Okay. I didn't quite catch that in your brief, but we can look.
Okay.
We'll look at the ruling.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. And I can look for that if you're interested. But that's my understanding that is what he said. That was one of the things. The other thing is that he found before trial, in the pretrial ruling, the defendant indicated. Let's see here. That. He didn't indicate that he had any other options, and they specifically talked about couldn't you have gone to the
guards?
Go to the guards and talk to them, and he explained the reasons why he thought that wasn't a reasonable option for him.
Isn't that a jury question?
And I agree that on the guards would be a jury question given that situation.
Okay. And
the thing at trial is that he admitted that he had other options. He said he had other options and that he should have pursued those options. And the other option was that he said he could have and he should have, he thought he should have now, that he should have gone to the other people in the prison, other people in the prison hierarchy of prisoners and the system that they have in place among the prisoners, mm-hmm. that he could have gone to them and talked to them because this was clearly just a misunderstanding, this threat, and that he understood that and that this was a misunderstanding and that he could have gone to them and cleared it up. And that he even said that's what had happened since, that he had, after the weapons had been found, he'd gone and he cleared this up. And he said, I should have done that. And that would have been a reasonable, legal alternative to the action that he took, that he admitted he could have taken. And if you have a reasonable, legal alternative, then you are not entitled to choice of evils. And that was something that hadn't come out at the pretrial hearing, but that he testified to at trial. And the court also relied on that and found that because there was a legal alternative option available, that legal alternative options available, that he was not entitled to the defense. And I think that, you had some discussion about what the standard was that the trial court applied. And I think that's just, it's just academic irrelevant at this point, because this court is a de novo review issue. And this court is going to apply some proper standard.
Yes, so we should apply the some competent evidence.
Yeah, I think it's some credible evidence is some credible evidence is what it says in the statute, and it's some competent evidence was what a couple of the cases said, but it was really based on the competent versus credible was based on just a misquotation, like they actually had it in quotes from the statute and said competent. Okay.
Is there a real difference between competent and credible evidence?
They're different words. If they use them in a statute separately, you would probably find some distinction between them. But I think as applied here by the court, that it was applying the standard that's applied in, you know, I'm sure hundreds of cases this judge has seen before about whether you should give an instruction. And the court did specifically say it was giving, taking all reasonable doubts, all inferences in favor of the defendant, in favor of giving the instruction.
So your position is, when he said it's an imminent threat, because the difference of 2 days and 5 days takes away the credibility of his testimony that it was imminent. And your position is, because he could have gone to the shot callers and knocked the guards and maybe changed the situation, his testimony that what he did was reasonable is not credible evidence. That has to be what we would have to hold, isn't it?
He never testified what I did is reasonable. He never testified what I did is improper.
He didn't use those words.
No. All he testified to was the facts, mm-hmm. and then the court analyzed the facts under the legal standard. And I think, you know, the defendant talks about, you know, having the rug pulled out from him. It was really his own testimony. It was really the facts of the case which did it. It's just as the facts of the case developed, they revealed that he does not have a choice of evils defense. And that once that happened, then it would have been proper to instruct on the issue, and that's why the court did not do so. And I think anyways, even if the court should have instructed on this for some reason, either because of the pretrial ruling or because there was some scintilla of evidence here, I think this court can say that it was harmless in this case.
Failure to give an instruction is harmless?
Mm-hmm. I think it could be harmless in this case. And the court the Colorado Supreme Court recently in Hagos emphasized that even constitutional errors need to be reviewed for harmlessness. And that if there's overwhelming evidence, then a constitutional error is harmless.
Overwhelming evidence of what here? That he had these objects in his cell?
Overwhelming evidence.
No one denied that. He didn't deny that.
I agree. Overwhelming evidence also that he was not acting pursuant to a choice of evils defense here. And he's at the standard for giving an affirmative defense instruction, and the standard for finding an error harmless are not the same. You give an instruction even if it wouldn't be reasonable to conclude that it applies. That's what they've specifically said that. But they said you have to have a reasonable possibility in order to reverse. And I think that distinction, if you find even there's some unreasonable chance, some scintilla of evidence here that they're going to find him holding it for 5 days and not even remembering that he had it anymore because he was so unconcerned about the threat, that even though the jail had been on lockdown for a day, so nobody was posing any threat to him for at least a day leading up to when these were discovered, and that he admitted he had these other options that he could have pursued but did not pursue, that under all those circumstances, there's just no reasonable possibility that if they'd given this instruction, the jury would have concluded that it applied to this case.
Jurors do some unusual things. It's hard to predict, frankly.
Well, we're supposed to treat them as reasonable, at least on appeal. And then just go to the mistrial for a second. I think that the trial court properly denied the defendant's request for a mistrial, and I think the easiest, cleanest way to look at this is just that in reviewing a motion for a mistrial, the first question is whether there was an error. And here, there wasn't an error. The trial court properly concluded that there was not sufficient evidence to give this instruction, and therefore didn't give the instruction, and there was no error to predicate this motion for mistrial on.
Let me clarify something, mm-hmm. if I might. This business about the difference in days, mm-hmm. the lockdown, mm-hmm. the possibility that he could have gone to the shock callers and changed the misunderstanding, I take it that did not come out until cross-examination?
That's correct. At least the shock callers stuff was definitely on cross-examination. Some of the specific stuff where he said 5 days specifically, he may have testified about, I think he testified on direct about the dates generally, and I think they're consistent with 5 days rather than 2 days.
I ask that because it seems surprising that the prosecution didn't begin to object to some of this evidence, and they kind of sandbagged him, so to speak. They let it all come in, and then all of a sudden they pulled the rug out from under him by saying, all that evidence now is going to be used against you and not in your defense.
And I don't think that was their intention or what actually occurred at all. They had a pretrial ruling. It said you can admit this evidence. That was the rule throughout the entire trial. He had the entire trial to present as much evidence as he wanted, and the prosecution wouldn't have had a grounds to object on that. They'd already argued and lost that issue. He can present that evidence. So throughout the entire trial, he had the opportunity, and he was allowed to present that evidence. And the prosecution didn't in any way interfere with it. The trial court didn't in any way interfere with that. And it wasn't until he rested that they had an opportunity to bring this issue up. That was the first time when it was like, when we had the evidence and when you could make this argument. Because up until that point, they didn't know what other evidence he was going to bring in. They didn't, they had the idea from the pretrial, but they didn't know until the evidence was completed whether there was going to be sufficient evidence to support an instruction on that issue. So I see my time's up. People have asked.
Thank you, Counselor.
To affirm the judgment of faith.
Counselor, I think you have about a minute 38.
May it please the court. The Attorney General just acknowledged that, all of the evidence that had been presented to Judge Taylor was presented at trial to Judge Kearns. That's the purpose of a trial. The prosecution had every opportunity to cross-examine and bring out nuances in the defense, and all of what the Attorney General just argued made for a nice closing argument. But as Judge Nay pointed out, and as Judge Richmond has observed, what happened was this defense was pulled out from underneath Mr. Willett's feet. All of the points that the Attorney General just made was with respect to, in the light most favorable to the prosecution, those things that would undermine the credibility of that defense. But he just acknowledged that all of the evidence that had been presented at the hearing was presented to the jury. It's the same evidence that this earlier court had ruled qualified as supporting the defense, some a scintilla of evidence, some credible evidence. If the court did in fact err, as the Attorney General assumed for a moment, it is not harmless. The Colorado Supreme Court has held on multiple occasions. It effectively reduces the prosecution's burden of proof and violates the defendant's due process rights. I think with that, I would ask the court to reverse Mr. Willett's convictions for introduction of contraband and remand for a new trial.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel for their arguments. Very nicely done. The case will be stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.